a song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Planetary Radio is public radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan, and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly Signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand, online at weeklysignals.com, or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KUCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are Arthur Plotnick and Janine Lattice. First up is Art Plotnick. He is former publishing executive and author of the Book of the Month Club Selections, The Elements of Editing and the Elements of Expression, Putting Thoughts into Words. He studied under Philip Roth at the Iowa Writers Workshop and has won numerous honors as editor of the American Library Association's flagship magazine, American Libraries. And if you read the Writer magazine, you no doubt have read his wonderful columns and wonderful pieces about writing. Let's bring him on. Hi, Art.
Hi, hi.
How are you?
I'm good. I was going to say thank you for having me, like some of your guests have said lately, but I was thinking about it's kind of a curious locution, isn't it, having me?
It's a location,
of course, you know, for having me on the show, but, you know, when talk shows get a celebrity, like Paris Hilton, they call it a get. You know that word?
Mm-hmm.
That one of those nouns from a verb. So Paris Hilton was a good get.
Mm-hmm.
So would I be a have, you think?
Would you be a have? No, you wouldn't be a have. You'd be a get, too.
Because when the show's over, you know, I don't want to have been had. These are my fears tonight, but anyway.
And these are the things you think about. This is great.
These are the things writers think about, the neurotics.
Well, you know, your book, Spunk and Bite, A Writer's Guide to Bold Contemporary Style, published by Random House Reference, is such a wonderful book about words and style and so much, I think, every writer would love and just delight in. It's I remember when this book came out in hardback last year, I picked it up and loved it. And then meant to get in touch with you back then, and somehow it just sort of didn't happen, and then I started thinking of you again, and that day the book, the paperback, was flung at my door by the UPS man, and I took it as a sign.
And it should be flung, you know, spunkily.
So talk about how this book came about and how your intense interest in words and origins and style and everything else came about.
Okay. Well, I should tell you, it wasn't the original title, which usually happens with books. It wasn't Spunk and Bite. It was called Rising to the Locution, one of the author's bad ideas. But and of course, the publishers, you know, locution, nobody knows what that means.
I like that, too. I do. But yeah, nobody, a lot of people wouldn't know what that means.
Yeah, and I agreed. So one of my other ideas was Spunk and Bite, which, of course, is a play on Strunk and White, the authors of the Elements of Style, that little coddled, revered Bible of composition.
Why is that so revered? I don't think I've ever read the whole thing. I think I've lost interest, and it's such a little, sweet little book, and I love E.B. White. I've never read through that book.
Yeah, well, you'll find out how revered it is if you ever try to knock it. It's like, you know, the Vishnu or Messiah that has its advocates. And it is a little, just the size of a piece of toast, you know. And it's great. It's for clarity and concision. It'll have you writing like butter. But I think, you know, for style that distinguishes writers in this competitive environment, it's kind of 50 years rancid.
Yeah.
And I imply this in the book, although I don't really knock or mock the guys. I take a cold shower in Strunk and White every so often for clarity.
But you do say quite a few things that would be, you know, pretty contrary, I think, to what he says, and Strunk and White has said in that book. And, you know, one is, don't always use a small word when a bigger word would do.
Yeah, you know, that's one of his inhibiting dictums, along with many others, such as, you know, don't inject opinion, don't use exclamations, don't use foreign words. There's a whole gulag of of inhibitions in there. But everything is relative, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we all like concision, and nobody wants more words than are necessary for the thought, but sometimes florid language, big, juicy, wonderful words are the right choice, the felicitous choice for your theme.
Same
like
with
Gothic novel or something. You want florid language.
Sure. I guess the challenge is knowing when to use what.
Yeah, and of course you meet that challenge in the editing process. You can't really think too much about it in the writing. You know, writing is editing, editing, editing.
Mm-hmm.
Good writing is bad writing edited to death.
Yeah.
Am I right? Right or wrong? you get the feel of the appropriate words as you edit.
I love what you do with color. I recall a chap, actually an article, and I don't know if this is the same article, if this was in the writer upgrading your colors. I can't remember. It doesn't matter, but I love how you talk about color, and how, you know, it's looking for that right color and not injecting, you know, cliches in terms of detail into your work.
Yeah, because you don't even see a cliche anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
Grass green, you don't think about it, you don't really see the green. But if, like Tom Wolfe, if you call a shirt hallway green... A Rust-Oleum brown,
right? You see
bookmailer stuffing gray. You can see those colors, you know,
right?
And they're fresh and surprising and inventive, which is what Spunk and Bite is about. That's my shorthand for the kind of inventiveness that's stimulating and surprising.
Well, how about reading a bit to us and give our listeners a taste of Spunk and Bite?
Okay. I chose this because so many people are having trouble describing extraordinary things. You know, we have narrowed ourselves to just a few choices: great, today's favorite, amazing. Are you getting to hate that word?
Pretty much.
I mean, I use it 10 times a day myself.
Yeah, right. Me too.
But then I flagellate myself with chains because. It's, you're like braying it, you know. It's so amazing. I hate the way that's braid. So try describing the extraordinary, say the extremely large, and see what happens. Immediately, the verbal channels are swamped by used-up modifiers. Great, huge, enormous, all yesterday's news. Cosmic? What isn't? Way cosmic. Way lame. Most writers wish to go beyond such adjectives, to boldly go where no word maven has gone before. But a rolling blackout darkens the brain. Life in the universe seems beyond the wattage of language. The events of one day drain the thesaurus. So many extraordinary things, so few terms to describe them. Reaching for extremes, non-writers or lazy writers fall back on the vocabulary of disbelief. It was just incredible. I mean, unbelievable. Well, such terms may define the borders of one's credulity. Unfortunately, they fail to distinguish the Piazza San Marco from a piece of pizza. Both are unbelievable. Extraordinary subjects call for the might of imagery, power imagery delivered as extreme figures of speech. I've dubbed such figures megaphors and, for descriptions of the extremely small, minophores. These special breeds of metaphor, simile, and hyperbola go the distance to catch the reader's imagination. A megaphor uses images of imposing size, force, or notoriety to augment a subject in an attention-getting way. Okay, let me pause. I offer some famous megaphors, such as Carl Sandburg's for Chicago, you know, City of the Big Shoulders, Hog Butcher for the World, along with contemporary ones, like what one critic called the prose of poor Sarah, Duchess of York. He called it a grisly shooting spree of meaningless analogies. But you see the force. Anyway, let me finish the reading with a word on metaphors, which are fun.
Okay.
The weak components of the universe challenge writers to venture even shrimpier in their metaphors. finding new ways to downsize the extremely small and insignificant. Conventional modifiers, tiny, diminutive, microscopic, cause less shrinkage than a cold wash cycle. Roget's downsizings offer a few more choices. Skosh, from the Japanese sukoshi, meaning a little bit. Minikin refers to a petite and dainty person, and soupçon means just a suspicion of a trace. And scintilla is a hissy word for a piddling amount. But a thesaurus can plunge only so far into the infinitesimal. Enter minophores, metaphorical figures for the extraordinarily puny. One thinks first of the smallest entities, subatomic particles. Though short on sensuality, they speak of diminishing space and have wonderful loopy names. Quark, lepton, gluon, muon, and so on. A paycheck the size of a muon is something most writers can relate to. Sometimes the best minophores, however, are based on moderately small items that the average reader can imagine. To physicists, particles in cloud chambers may connote dinky, but the smallness of zits, peanuts, and mustard seeds can be better pictured and felt by others. And I could say arcanely that someone's authority extends about one Planck length, a reference to the smallest reducible interval of time and space. But parsley on the fish, as one executive described her board's role, says it even smaller.
Thank you so much. That was great.
Funny thing is, I'm the kind of guy that eats the parsley and sometimes leaves the fish, so maybe it's not so insignificant.
Oh, if you just tuned in, you were listening to Art Plotnick read from Spunk and Bite, A Writer's Guide to Bold Contemporary Style, published by Random House Reference. You should, I don't know, is this book on CD yet or tape? And will it be? Because you should be the one who reads it. Tell them you're going to read it.
No, it's not, but I'm open to offers. There's plenty of Hollywood agents listening to this show as they drive on the freeway, right?
That's right. You know, you have written so much about editing. You have a book about editing. How much of your book, how much of Spunk and Bite happened in the first draft, and how much happened through the revision process? I mean, I imagine that it came out like this first draft with you.
Only Jack Kerouac can write a first draft. When you write it on one continuous roll of paper and walked away. But no, you know, probably 80% in editing. These started as essays, and part of them became articles. I rewrote and rewrote and expanded. And then, you know, it's how it is in word processing. You can't count the number of revisions, but, you know, I've returned to the manuscript maybe 25, 50 times, according to what you can see on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to moil. You know, you said it yourself in your wonderful book, Miss Pen on Fire. where you felt your teeth ache and your heart ache or something, your teeth hurt, trying to get a word right.
Yeah.
You have to moil while the rest of the world is having fun. But, of course, you know, we writers have this weird kind of fun. That's fun for us, I suppose.
It is a weird kind of fun.
But it's moiling, and it's work, and you're always tempted to run off and do something else, right?
Even you?
Yeah, that's why your book is so good, because, you know, I'm going to check into a motel, I think, as you suggest for my next, before I get started on the next one.
Oh.
And turn off the TV.
And turn off the TV, which is hard to do for us during baseball season, so, Oh, dear. Anyway, how about adverbs? I love what you say in this book about adverbs because, you know, everywhere we read, bring out the modifier police, and even I have said that. And I've changed my thinking a little bit. I think that a great adverb can just do a ton for a paragraph or for a sentence. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, good adverbs adverbs are becoming kind of trendy, and I hope they don't ruin them. The New York Times uses a lot, like a lot of contrast adverbs that contrast with their subject, like mm-hmm. engagingly, oxymorons, we call them engagingly demented,
mm-hmm.
pointlessly handsome, something I've grappled with my whole life. Woundingly beautiful, in your case. But they're fun, you know. And, of course, we don't want an adverb when the a verb or adjective does the job itself, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to say, he howled loudly, right? But or he belched loudly, because belches are loud. But Kingsley Amis, when he says he belched, he erupted liverishly. And I want to elevate that adverb to knighthood. It's wonderful. She read my poetry liverishly. Right? He was yawningly brilliant. I think the Brits started all this, didn't they, with their, you know, you couldn't just say awfully rich. You couldn't just say rich. It was awfully rich, frightfully rich. Lashingly funny. I'm engorgingly in love with you.
Oh, dear. What about dialogue?
Those were adjectives, you know, that adjectives can be the star of the show. So these rules, you know, avoid adverbs, avoid
right,
adjectives.
Right, right. That's true. They can be the star of the show, huh?
Yeah, you know, this example I liked recently was sex with her husband was set-asideable. Set-asideable as a floppy disk. Hope none of your readers can identify with that, but it's a good adjective.
That's great.
Your listeners, I mean.
What about dialogue tags? Talk about that a little, because that seems to be something that writers grapple with quite a bit.
Yeah, and again, you know, you have a convention. Just use said. Don't try to get cute and say he whined, he grumbled, and so on. Well, tell that to J.K. Rowling, right, who uses that kind of thing all the time, and she's done fairly well with it. Oh, I should have her money. So going the other way can be annoying, too. You want to know who said what. Some writers leave them off entirely. They leave off quotation marks even. Some even run them into single paragraphs, so you don't know who's saying what or how they said it. But I want to know how people say certain things, and if the context doesn't deliver it, I want to know that they said something liberishly.
Oh, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Art Plotnick, author of Spunk and Bite, A Writer's Guide to Bold Contemporary Style by Random House Reference. We have a few minutes left. You also are a proponent of the thesaurus. You read some books that say, never look at a thesaurus. Write naturally. Let your, you know, use the words you use.
Yeah, you know, one of those so-called authorities say that that it's going to lead inept writers to false synonyms. Well, <yeah. laughs> excuse me, I think writers can figure out these things for themselves when a synonym clicks. And, you know, you'd be a fool not to stimulate yourself with all those choices that not only remind you of words you know, but plenty of good ones you can look up. It's true that some of the thesaurus words become cliche because everybody uses them. But what I do, this little trick I mention in the book, is not to go to the subject itself, but just open the book at random. So if I want a synonym for for bright light, you know, for bright.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go to bright. I don't go to brightness or illumination because those are all used up. I just open the book and I find a word like savage, you know, savagely bright, savage light, or it was berserkly bright. It works almost, you know, three lookups and you've got a great, three random lookups, you've got a great new synonym.
That's great. That's a great tip.
But you know, it's fun just to browse the thesaurus, and the new ones have wonderful lists of gods and diseases and odd things. Well, it's a perfect way to avoid writing.
But it's also a way to I don't know, amp up your writings, you know, give it some freshness and fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I like to look in glossaries, too, you know, that have a lot of specialized words that you can apply as metaphors, or maybe a sailing glossary, or some of the urban dictionaries on the internet are wonderful. So there's many sources other than a thesaurus for fresh words. I also advise these word of the day websites. Try to learn one word a week, even one good writer's word, out of the seven that these websites feed you each week, and it adds up.
Do you have a website?
Better than the stock market.
Do you have a website?
Pardon me?
Do you have a website?
Yes, a couple of them. Spunkandbite.com for the book, and that has some autobiographical stuff that will lead you to the innermost secrets on another site.
Now, now, your last name, Plotnik, is that actually your name, or did you create that name when you started writing about writing?
Yeah, how about Arthur Plotnik? Nobody can.
Seriously, I mean, you had
to grow up. That's like a boy named Sue. You know,
you had to become, you know, a writer and do the sorts of writing that you do with that name. You just had to.
Well, in one of my books, which is now called The Elements of Authorship, I give some autobiography, but the character is named Plotnikov. So that sounds a little better. That's actually, in Russian, Plotnik means carpenter, a hewer, hewer of words. So it's very appropriate. Hmm. Art Carpenter, just call me.
Well, I like Plotnik, and I love your work, and I love this book, and I love the quote on the front by Billy Collins, who also loves your book. So,
I love Billy Collins, not just for loving my book, but favorite poet. But he is an old chum. We both grew up in White Plains. But he wouldn't blurb it if he didn't like it.
That's right.
Believe me.
He wouldn't. And I would have liked it anyway, but I saw his little quote there after I already loved the book and just thought that was great.
I heard your interview with him.
Oh, you did?
Terrific.
Well, this show will be up on the podcast in a week or so that all my podcast listeners can listen. And I so thank you for taking the time. This really was not enough time, and so if you'll come back soon, that would be great.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And as Noel Lukman said on your show, thank you for all you do for writers.
Thank you.
And thank you for having me.
I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
That was Art Plotnik, author of Spunk and Bite. Really a wonderful book. I love this book, and I think all writers really need to take a look and just swim in it. Have fun with this book. It's gorgeous. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will have Janine Lattice with us. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
It's appalling. That's my reaction to a system that requires customers to buy groceries by running their finger over a scanner. Fingerprint shopping is being tested at grocery stores across the country. In a program system, your fingerprint is linked to your credit card or bank account. At best, fingerprint matching is only 80% accurate, and all technology can be compromised. Who takes the print to set up your account? A checker trained in biometrics? Hardly. Where are the laws that define the purchase, sale, or transfer of these unique parts of your body to others? And where's the time-saving factor? You still have to key in a code, sign a receipt, and say paper or plastic. I'm Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. To learn more about this issue and other privacy issues, join us on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Still, we spent our first half hour with Art Plotnick, author of Spunk and Bite, and we are back for another half hour with Janine Latus, author of If I Am Missing or Dead, A Sister's Story of Love, Murder, and Liberation. Janine has been a freelance writer and radio and TV personality for more than a decade. She gives speeches all over the place on both domestic violence and the art of writing well. She serves on the board of directors of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, which is how I met her, and lives in Virginia with her daughter. Hi, Janine.
Hey, Barbara.
Great to have you on. Your book, If I Am Missing or Dead, talk about how it came about.
Back in 2002, I was on the East Coast on a business trip, and I got a phone call from my big sister, and she said, "Have you heard from Amy?" And Amy is our baby sister, and I knew from that moment that she was dead. It took us weeks to find her body, but as it turned out, she had been strangled by her lover.
Yeah. And what do you do with that as a writer? I mean, as a sister, it's one thing. As a writer,
well,
what do you
do? Barbara, you and I are the same way in that there is only one way to deal with things, and that is as a writer. And so I wrote contemporaneously because it kept me from going crazy. I had to keep putting it down and putting it down to get it out of myself. And so when the time came, I wrote an Oprah article, and then I wrote the book. And when I went to write about these things, I had the material because at the time, when I was feeling it the most intensely, I was writing it down.
Mm-hmm. The structure of the book is interesting. It's talk about coming to the structure.
Well, I wanted so much to make it a double helix about the two sisters, but I didn't have enough material to truly write my sister's side of the story. And in order to write her side, I would have had to guess or extrapolate or do fiction. And so what I did, and as you've read the book, you know, there's a section in there that has my sister's journal writings. She was at my house for Christmas. She was playing charades and poker and joking around with the nieces and nephews. And then she was walking downstairs and writing these really anguished, painful things in her journal. And it made it really clear to me that what I saw on the surface and what I would have guessed to be her reality was not her reality. Her reality was something much darker.
Hmm. So, okay, so the book begins with an essay that was an Oprah, wonderful essay, with accompanied by photographs of Amy and you and other family members. Talk about taking it from an essay and sort of expanding that essay into this book.
Do you want the writing side or the got an agent kind of business side?
Let's talk about the writing side.
The writing side was so exciting. What I would do was I would go to this independent coffee shop every morning, and I would sit in this particular chair, and I would open up whatever I was writing on. I'm going to open my laptop and go to the document I was working on, and I would do a word count, and I would write down how many words I had in that document. I had read in Stephen King's book on writing that he wrote 2,000 words a day. And I figured, since he has a staff and a wife, and I have neither, that I would write 1,000 words a day. And so I wouldn't stop writing until that number on my napkin had increased by 1,000. But because the material I was working with was so painful and hard, really hard to recreate, both as a craftsperson and as a sister, sometimes I couldn't move forward on whatever I was writing, in which case I would simply move to a different scene and move that forward until collectively I had 1,000 words. But I wrote the whole book in scenes. Sometimes I would look at photographs and I would say, okay, at this particular moment, this was happening. And then I would write the events leading up to it and then the events trailing away from it so that the scenes themselves would have a narrative arc. But because the material was so painful, I would just write on one scene, and then when I couldn't move forward, I would move to a different one.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Would you read now? This might be a good time to let the readers hear from you, hear from this book.
All right.
Before we go on.
And I chose not from the beginning of the book because one of the things that I think is so important in my world and in this book is to make people aware of emotional abuse, because there's such a spectrum of emotional and physical abuse that I wanted to depict it, and I wanted people to feel it from the inside. I didn't want to talk about it. I wanted readers to feel it. So this chapter is like a third of the way into the book.
Okay.
I flip off the radio and the lights and jump out of my car, still singing. It has taken a plane and a two-hour drive to get home from my business meeting in New York, and now my garage door opener isn't working. I wrestle my suitcase out of the back and wheel it to the front door. The motion detector light comes on, but the door is locked. "Hello, hello," I call, pushing repeatedly on the doorbell. It makes a cheerful ding-dong, ding-dong, ding-dong in the house. I shift from foot to foot, doing the I drank too much soda and I have to pee dance as I hear the thunder of the children running across the hardwood. Claire gets there first and struggles with the lock while her brother tries to hip-check her aside. Finally, they get it open. "You're home," they yell. I open my arms and Claire rushes in. She's wearing a bright green full-length skirt I made for her dress-up collection and a wedding veil. "What did you bring us?" I laugh. "Hello. Welcome home. We love you. How was your trip?" "Yeah, yeah, yeah," Mikey says. "But what did you bring us?" I reach out and pull him into the hug. "Help me bring in my bag and we'll see." My nearly tall stepson reaches for the suitcases and yanks it up over the threshold, and both kids fall on it, wrestling for the zipper. "You better hope it's nothing fragile," I say. I hear Kurt round the corner. "What the hell are you doing?" he asks. The kids freeze, and I swallow hard. "Hi, honey," I say, turning. "What are you doing? How come you didn't come in through the garage?" I step between him and the kids. "My garage door opener didn't work," I say. "I must have programmed it wrong." I look at the kids, their eyes wide and mouths open, then back at their father, who steps closer. I cross my arms over my chest. "Fine," he says. "That's fine. You ruin everything, so why not this?" My lips start to shake, and I step back, almost tripping over the kids. "You just take off and leave us, and then I try to do something nice for you, and you ruin it," he says, stepping forward again. "What the hell are you talking about?" I ask. "I just walked in the door." "Right. You just walked in the door after doing God knows what in New York, and you don't even notice all I've done for you." I look around. "The house looks great," I say, quashing any impulse to ask why he should get points for doing the little chores that go unnoticed when I do them every day. "Do I smell manicotti?" "Nice try," he says, "but too little, too late." I glance at the kids who have crept behind me. "What?" I demand. "What is it this time?" He steps closer, his breath hitting me in the face, and tears fill my eyes. He clenches his teeth. "Why don't you go back out?" he hisses. "Get in your stupid car and try your damn garage door opener again." I step backward over my suitcase, gathering the kids to my sides as I do. "Good idea," I say. "Let's start over. Kids, come with me." "No," Kurt says. "No, we are not doing this your way. The kids stay in here with me, since they're part of what's left of the surprise." I look each child in the eye, offering silent reassurance. Without turning my back on my husband, I step out the door and around the corner, out of sight. Only then do I let myself cry, big gulping sounds that start somewhere deeper than my chest. What have I done? Why have I screwed up? He was obviously trying to do something nice, and I've blown it. I slide into my car, close my eyes, and grip the steering wheel. "Damn it, damn it, damn it," I say, pounding my head against the wheel until I miss aim and hit the horn. The garage door opens and Kurt bends double and ducks out. "We were coming," he says. "Quit it with the damn horn." He ducks back in and the door rattles back down. I stare. Now what am I supposed to do? I flip down the visor and check my makeup. 2 hours earlier, I had stopped in the airport bathroom to pretty up for him. Now my mascara is smeared. I wet my fingers, run them under my eyes, and then snort. My friends always ask if I'm afraid to go to New York. Hell no. I'm afraid to come home.
Thank you so much. That was Janine Latis reading from If I Am Missing or Dead, A Sister's Story of Love, Murder, and Liberation, published by Simon & Schuster. This book is such an honest, moving book. A couple of questions around that. One is, as you were writing it, did you ever worry what relatives might say, think, what your ex would do, would say, would feel? What do you do with those worries in terms of the writing? How do those worries affect the writing? Or did you just say, you know, I'm going to get down a draft and I'll just deal with it later?
It was bigger than that. It was, first of all, to the first part of the question, I had enormous concerns about what my family and my ex-husband would do, and my children. I really struggled with it, but I also felt like I had to do it because it was the only way I could make anything good come out of Amy's murder. She had died, and if I did something with that, she would have a legacy. She would live in some way. And if I didn't do it, if I was afraid to do it, then she wouldn't. And I knew, I mean, the only person I really cared about was my mother. I just didn't want her to suffer anymore. But everybody else, I thought, you can hate me forever. I have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I was very concerned that my ex-husband would sue me. And I spent a lot of energy on that. And yet I still said, you know, if he wipes me out, he wipes me out. I have to do this.
Hmm. And so did you ever at any point other than your mother run anything by anybody or, you know, before you got a draft out there, got a draft to your agent, say, okay, I'm going to check it with you? Or did you just go, like you just said, you know, you didn't want your mother to suffer, but it was going to go.
Let's see. It was, first of all, I have to say, it's amazing to me that my family kept their hands off of it. If one of my siblings had come to me and said, I'm going to write a book and it's going to include you, I would have said, don't tell the story about the time I, you know, whatever. Or I would have asked to see a draft. And each one of them left their hands off of it.
Mm.
And I'm just incredibly grateful to them for that.
Yeah.
And then I gave a draft to, I gave the manuscript to my mother. I had gone to my agent, but hadn't gone to my editor, I think. And among the things that happened is that I was raped when I was 19. And there is a scene in the book that tells that story in detail, because as I said, I really want readers to feel what happened, not think of it intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother hadn't known I'd been raped. And so here she is reading this really explicit rape scene, and it's her daughter. That was really hard.
Yeah. What about, The dialogue throughout the book is not enclosed within quotes. Talk about that.
Mm. That was important to me because I'm trained as a journalist, and I could not swear that these were exact quotes, and therefore they can't be in quotation marks.
Mm-hmm.
And I also felt like there's a component of what I was trying to do, which is to have you feel, did you read The Strange Case of the Dog in the Night?
No, but I know the book. Go ahead.
Well, so you're into the book. I mean, well into it, three-quarters of the way through it, before you realize that the protagonist has autism.
Uh-huh.
And so you're reading the book, and there's something wrong, and you're reading it, and you're feeling kind of swirly and off balance, as if the world is not the three-dimensional place you're used to. And it's because eventually you realize he's written this from the perspective of an autistic person without telling you the person is autistic. And when I wrote my book, I was trying to make you feel the kind of insecurity, the unsureness of reality that happens when you're deep inside an emotionally abusive relationship.
Hmm. I like that there are no quotes. It also gives it sort of a dreamlike quality.
There you go. That's what I was trying to say, but you're better at it.
Did you ever consider writing a novel instead of a memoir? I mean, I realize being a journalist, a memoir would most likely occur to you first, but I guess I'm just thinking about, you know, where you have to go into Amy's psyche, and you have to do a bit more with that. Did you go, well, maybe I could try it as a novel and see what happens?
I didn't want to do this one as a novel because I didn't want it dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
But I am now working with a novel, and it's funny because I'm not trying to go into Amy's psyche, I'm trying to go into the men's.
Mm.
I'm trying to understand why men would behave this way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a really interesting exercise for me to try to deal with compassion with people like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Oh, that'll be interesting.
Yeah, it makes the first couple hours of every day kind of kind of weird.
Before I forget, tell our listeners about your website.
The website for the book is called www.ifiammissingordead.com, and it gives you a it gives you a sample chapter, and it gives you ways to buy the book, but it also gives you links to Amy's Courage, which is a fund being managed by the National Network to End Domestic Violence that gives money directly to women who need to flee. So like a first month's rent or a car repair or a medical bill. All you have to do as a reader is, you know, have this impulse to do something. And if you can contribute to Amy's Courage, then it goes directly to some woman who's trying to get out.
Yeah. Well, what do you hear from readers?
Oh, my gosh. The book has been out for 3 or 4 months now in this country and a little bit shorter time in London. And I get emails from the Arctic Circle in Australia and, you know, England and the U.S. all the time and Canada. And people saying to me, thank you, I don't feel alone anymore. And thank you for finally telling my story. And as you know, I think, I've also been called a self-absorbed nymphomaniac. So it goes both ways.
Well, yeah. Wow. What do you do with that? What do you do with that sort of reaction from readers? Are you able to, you know, let it go in, be bothered a little bit, and then let it go out? Or what do you do?
Most of it I just let wash over me. And because I did what I did from the my bones, and most people are really touched or strengthened by it, and some people need to get you know, irritable about it, and I just have to think, okay, the readers are all coming at it from their own place, and their place is different from my place, which is a really woo-woo way of saying what I really do is if I get one of those, I just go, you have issues. Let's not overstate my, adultness here. But these other ones, you know, I get these people who have decided to get out because of my book, or they handed it to their mother, and they're finally telling each other the truth because of my book.
Yeah.
And I wrote it to start a national conversation about this spectrum of emotional and physical abuse, and, you know, if my email is in the indicator, it's happening.
Yeah, it's happening. And you've done a wonderful thing by writing your book, and every one of us either has been in this situation or knows someone who has been or is, and I love that you have started the conversation or brought it out.
Thank you.
Any sort of words of wisdom for the writers who are listening who may be grappling with a difficult memoir book that they're, or even an essay that they're trying to write that is loaded for them?
You know, I had a man come to one of my readings. He happens to be somebody I know. And he said, how did you do this? Because when I try, I end up sitting alone in the room, chewing pencils and crying. And I said to him, I didn't sit alone in the room. I went to this coffee shop, and I sat there, and even though I didn't talk to other people, I mean, I did, you know, chit-chat, then I would sit down, and this cone of silence would descend. But if I needed to look up and resurface, there were always people there willing to just kind of have a conversation with me. And taking it out to a public place made me feel less alone, made me recognize that my life isn't like that anymore, and it gave me a ritual. I go here, and when I go here, I write. when I'm at home, you know, I do the laundry and I empty the dishwasher and pitter-patter around. But when I go to the coffee shop, I'm going to the coffee shop to write. So for me, I teared up at the coffee shop on occasion, and I had people tell me that I looked completely different when I was writing than when I wasn't writing, because I went to what they called the dark place. But they accepted that. And I remember one day I was writing probably for about 2 hours, and then I looked up, and it was like surfacing. And I looked at this man across from me, and I said, I just wrote a really good sentence. And he just stared at me. You've been sitting there that long, and you wrote a sentence? And I said, oh, no, I wrote a lot of sentences, but I just wrote one that was really good.
Oh, yeah. It helps to bring it into the public arena to get out of the house, and helps get writing done. Helps
yeah.
Get,
yeah, and I wrote every day, and I would encourage everybody to do that, because you don't lose track of your plot line, you don't lose track of your characters, which obviously is less of an issue on a memoir, and you give yourself that habit so that you make it move forward every day.
Yeah. Well, I very much appreciate you taking the time to be on this show, and this show will be podcast in another week or so, so the listeners that didn't catch it now can catch it then.
Fantastic.
Thanks so much, Janine.
Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Janine Latus speaking to us from the East Coast. Her book is If I Am Missing or Dead, A Sister's Story of Love, Murder, and Liberation by Simon & Schuster. All right, we're at the end of our time. If you want to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. I'm going to leave you with a quote by John Steinbeck, who said, "We are lonesome animals. We spend all of our life trying to be less lonesome. One of our ancient methods is to tell a story, begging the listener to say and to feel, yes, that is the way it is, or at least that is the way I feel it. You're not as lone as you thought." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing at 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'll see you next time.